Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation. It's Monday, February 10th. Immigration advocates rallied this weekend as the federal sweep to arrest those in this country illegally moves into high gear. A push to pass a ban on cell phones in public schools appears to be dead for this session, but education officials are already working on a policy which some hope could be in place for the new school year. We hear from the founder of a technology incubator about training Hawaii's emerging talent, and we learn about a new initiative to help nurture native Hawaiian contemporary artists that kicks off this month. And we honor Satoru Abe, whose modernist art can be seen across Hawaii. 2024 was quite a year for the prolific Hawaii artist. The 90-year-old painter and sculptor had not one but two exhibits highlighting his work. Abe died last week, and we Hanahoa segment about his art and influence. Tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. Dozens of people gathered outside the state capitol over the weekend to protest the immigration raids now sweeping the country. President Donald Trump has promised to build new detention facilities across the U.S. and on military base at Guantanamo Bay. Just this weekend, a federal court blocked the president from sending three Venezuelan nationals to Guantanamo, and many legal questions about his plan are up in the air. But at the Saturday rally, Yuri Casasola spoke to the Honolulu Star Advertiser about his concerns.
We're here because of this humanitarian crisis, the refugee crisis we have on our borders. Our authorities have deemed it appropriate and right to start putting children in cages, separating families. We think that's an immoral, disgraceful thing to do, that it goes against our values as Americans. I'm a first generation immigrant myself. I came over undocumented. We and my family have established roots. Our family's grown. We're productive, law-abiding citizens of this country. And that's what this country's always based on, is immigration.
The Trump administration's crackdown on illegal immigrants isn't the first time the U.S. has undertaken a mass detention. Following the attack on Pearl Harbor, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt authorized the roundup of 120,000 Japanese Americans, including 1,800 here in Hawaii. Elizabeth Fujiwara has worked as a civil rights lawyer for 38 years. Through her career in researching her own family history, she took a closer look at the detention of Japanese Americans and Japanese nationals during World War II. She testified in support of a bill at the legislature which would prohibit the use of public lands for immigration detention facilities. The Conversation's D.W. Gibson talked with Fujiwara about the historical parallels between the internment of Japanese Americans in 1941 and the current raids looking for illegal immigrants.
Walk us through as you understand, the immediate aftermath of December 7th, the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941. How soon did FDR order the internment of Japanese Americans, and how did that process play out of building up that network?
Just about 2 months after the Pearl Harbor attack, he issued Executive Order 9066. And the problem in Hawaii became that the folks of Japanese ancestry were about one-third of the population here. Although most of them were Japanese Americans, there were still, of course, several Japanese nationals who had come here to Hawaii as plantation workers. And what happened was General George Marshall, he said not to ship the Japanese in Hawaii to the mainland because that would interfere with what was going on with the war. And then we were lucky we had a Lieutenant General Emmons, and he did an investigation and found that there was no active sabotage. So he kept delaying sending Japanese from Hawaii to the mainland. But nevertheless, they still arrested over 2,000 Japanese folks here and 1,875 of them were eventually transferred to the mainland. But the good news was this protected about 98% of the citizens and residents of Japanese ancestry. And on top of that, we had martial law. We became like a military fortress. The folks were fingerprinted and registered in the whole military bureaucratic system. They had to carry ID cards at all times. They were subjected to curfews, blackouts, and censorship. And there were no jury trials. All court proceedings were transferred to military court, and travel was restricted.
I think this is something on people's minds these days as the Trump administration looks in some cases to local law enforcement to collaborate on immigration detentions. And I wonder if you could speak a little bit more about that, how the local law enforcement reacted and interfaced with the federal government at this time.
At that time, the mayors and the police actually helped. However, because the Japanese Americans and their parents, the Issei, were so involved in the community, they were protected from so many being incarcerated as compared to the mainland, where we know that there were over 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry that were summarily incarcerated just because they were Japanese. Here we were lucky. We had John Burns. He was a police officer, and he prevented many, 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 many people from being arrested and incarcerated just because they were Japanese. So although the mayors and the police did cooperate, there was a sense that this is not the same situation as the mainland, because we didn't have here the same type of prejudice. On the mainland, if you were Japanese, you could not even buy property. In Hawaii, you could. There wasn't any type of segregation here like there was on the mainland. Here, it was more like a social, economic segregation. You had the wealthy sugar planters, obviously, and then the folks who worked for them, which were a lot of originally the Japanese, among the other groups, of course. And also by this time, a lot of Japanese Americans and Japanese nationals had gone into business besides working on the plantation. So they actually had a lot of white friends and other ethnic groups and business partners with white folks. And they also went to integrated schools, which is really different from the mainland. Well, I should say integrated public schools. Basically, Japanese American kids went to school with everybody. So you had a whole different energy here in Hawaii, where people knew the Japanese Americans here, the Japanese nationals. They were neighbors. They were in the same church, perhaps, and they went to the same celebrations. So there wasn't that sense that these are the enemy, whereas on the mainland, it didn't matter. You were Japanese, you had to go to the detention facilities, and you had to suffer there for many years. Most people stayed about 4 years in prison just because they were Japanese.
Yeah, it sounds like the interpersonal nature of the communities in the islands was a differentiating factor, where people on the mainland were dealing with sweeping generalizations and ideas in their head as opposed to names and faces and people they knew.
At the same time, though, a lot of the Japanese, they didn't feel comfortable speaking Japanese in public, and they changed their business names from Japanese to English, and they would destroy any Japanese language books or newspapers, and they stopped having Japanese celebrations like the bon dances and so forth that everybody likes in the summer. So it was a whole different way of living. It was scary. There were 10,000 Japanese Americans who were arrested and interrogated, and so there was a whole fear that if you were of Japanese descent, you could be taken into custody at any time. In other words, it's like under martial law, you don't have any protections, right? The Constitution doesn't exist. So these 10,000 folks were arrested and interrogated, and there was so much fear. It was just a feeling of, am I next?
And your comment about living with this idea, this question rather, of am I next? I hear a little echo there as I talk to immigrants in the state now who might lack documentation, who might be feeling that precarity. And I wonder, as a civil rights lawyer, what jumps out to you in terms of parallels we should pay attention to when it comes to the camps that were set up in the wake of the attack of Pearl Harbor and the approach of the current presidential administration in terms of mass detention?
Well, it's very, very very similar. That's what's very, very scary. Clearly, there were violations of the Constitution. They violated the Fourth Amendment. They violated the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment, of course, is about search and seizure. And the Fifth Amendment is about due process, where you should have a notice and hearing. And what they're doing now, the PR that they're putting out is, oh, yeah, we're just arresting criminals, but no, they're not. And the other problem, of course, is after the Pearl Harbor attack, there was some so-called quote-unquote rational reason we're at war. There's no war here. There's nothing going on which would even call for such mass deportation as what they are doing now. And what's different now? We actually have our own constitution in Hawaii. In Hawaii, we have under Article 1, Section 5, the Due Process Clause, which is like the Fifth and Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. And in our Article 1, Section 7, we have search and seizure protections, which, of course, is similar to the Fourth Amendment. And on top of that, we have an invasion of privacy protections in our own constitution. So there's now state law of our own Hawaii Supreme Court in a very interesting case just a year ago, State versus Wilson, where our Supreme Court was very clear that the state constitution should prevail when there's a question. So I think our Hawaii Supreme Court will definitely enforce our Hawaii constitution as far as possible when it comes to all of these issues. Our Hawaii Supreme Court is very, very protective of individual rights, including immigrants who are still considered aliens. So I think that's the best news of the day.
You mentioned in your testimony before the legislature that one of the main injuries caused by the internment camps during World War II was a sense of humiliation. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you've come to understand through your work about the psychological challenges people face when their civil rights are blunted.
What happened in those camps so often was they were just fed out of the garbage cans. And the tar paper in some of the camps would just fall off, and the people would freeze in the winter and be hot as hell in the summer. And the reparations was nice, but what does that do when there was finally Japanese reparations in 1988? Nothing. I think just going through all of that, it just makes people feel as if they don't count. And I see that a lot in just doing regular employment discrimination cases. So I can't even imagine what it was like to be totally humiliated every single day for 4 years and have military police have their rifles pointing at you. And in fact, in Manzanar, there was a resistance by the residents of the internment camp, and the army shot 11 of them and they killed two. So this was not a Boy Scout camp, you know. You do the wrong thing and you're dead. And I think that's the stress and the humiliation from that is unbelievable. How do you even survive? So back then they didn't have anything called post-trauma stress disorder, which we now know a lot about. That whole generation of 120,000 people plus our 1,800 folks from Hawaii had to have had it the rest of their lives. How do you overcome that kind of trauma that lasted for 4 straight years, and you could see people dying in front of you where there was rampant infection, not good medical facilities, and you were told if you were disloyal, you would be relocated to a worse camp, and then you had a choice. Oh, you should go fight, or you would be treated badly, and it's like, what were the choices? I mean, you were prisoners. These are prisons. That's why I never quite understood that word of camp, how they were always called internment camps. They were prisons.
That was civil rights lawyer Elizabeth Fujiwara talking to HPR's G.W. Gibson about the parallels between the internment of Japanese Americans in World War II and the current crackdown on illegal immigrants.
In Italy, a 700-year-old fresco found in a Christian church shows an Islamic tent hanging over the altar. The real-life tent might have been a diplomatic gift or perhaps a spoil of war, but either way, it reveals cultural exchange between Christianity and Islam going back further than previously thought. That story next time on The World.
beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
It appears that efforts to pass bills to ban cell phones in public schools are dead on arrival. The only bill to get a hearing in the Senate was killed by the Education Committee last week. The reason? The school board is already working on a policy that some hope will be in place at the start of the new school year. Here with the update is HPR's Cassie Ordonio. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so I'm told the current policy pretty much leaves it up to individual schools to work out the details. But then lawmakers want to give the board more time to come up with something more consistent.
Yeah, and this goes on par with there are about 19 states across the nation that either have a law or some policies that either ban cell phones statewide or leave it up to their individual school districts. But for Hawaii, we're kind of in a unique situation because we're a single school district. But there were several bills that would have required the State Board of Education to create a statewide policy on cell phone bans, but those efforts failed. And that one measure, Senate Bill 684, was the one that the only bill that got a hearing last week and was quickly killed by the Senate Education Committee. And when I spoke to Senator Michelle Kidani, who chairs that committee, she says that she's leaving it up to the Board of Education to create such a policy.
Okay, and you talked to the school board chairman. What did he have to say?
So Roy Takumi said that currently the Board of Education Student Achievement Committee is looking at creating a potential cell phone policy or proposal along with another policy for artificial intelligence, and they're coming up with those strategies to bring to the full board sometime in the coming months. Roy Takumi said that once they bring the proposal, he's anticipating maybe there's going to be some type of vote on it, but that's still kind of in the works. He also said it's unclear, you know, what that's going to look like on a statewide level and whether that's going to be that cell phone ban policy is going to be either just all K through 12 or if it's just going to be for the middle schools and then high schools. He said his granddaughter is an example or her high school is an example of a cell phone ban. And she's currently a senior at a high school in Las Vegas, Nevada.
During the class period, they put their phone in a pouch that has a number on it, which corresponds with their desk number, and then they put it in a cubbyhole. And then when the period's over, they go up and take out their phone, and then they go to the next period and put it into the numbered pouch again. And then during lunch, obviously, they can use their phone. She at first hated it, but now she said she really likes it because there's far less distractions in class. Actually, her schoolwork has improved. I suspect there'll be resistance at the beginning whenever you come up with any kind of new thing. But just using my granddaughter as an example, she got used to it and she prefers it now because there's less fooling around in class.
And I imagine then when the school board passes the policy that they'll give the students some time to get used to the idea.
Yeah, and that's actually happening at other states as well. They're also trying to kind of gear up with this policy, whether it's statewide or for certain local school districts. But a lot of schools here are taking matters into their own hands. There are some schools that have an outright ban, like, for example, the Kihei Charter School. They recently invested in the Yonder Pouches, which is this fabric pouch that students will put their cell phones in, and it's a magnetic lock, and the only way you can get that magnetic lock to unopen is to use another magnetic device. But that cell phone ban at the Kihei Charter School, they're only not allowed to use it during class instructions, and they get their cell phones back after that class period is over. But when Roy Takumi brought that up, him and the board, they were thinking of maybe if they were going to implement such a statewide ban, the Honor Pouches are kind of expensive. They're about $20 to $30. And then, you know, that consider that for 165,000 public school students, doing the math, that could cost the DOE more than $4.9 million. And then what would happen, he said, what would happen if the students would damage the pouches? And I'm talking to the Kihei Charter School superintendent over there, or the executive director, he was saying that some of the pouches have been damaged. There are some students who are trying to cut it open and whatnot. I did talk to Deborah Bond Upson, who's the president of the Parents for Public School Hawaii, who is working with a startup company called Ditezo on a QR code for students.
They could use it for emergency purposes, but they can't do anything else. When they leave the class, they hold it up and it unlocks. A solution like that seems like a better idea to me than either a blanket ban, which I think would be very unpopular, actually, with parents, or the other alternative, which a lot of parents in our poll pointed to, which is what's done now mostly, which is the teacher collects every phone at the beginning of class, and then at the end of class, hands it back. And the problem with that solution is it's taking a lot of the teacher's time. But also, the family and the student are afraid of losing the phone. These are valuable, expensive phones. And if it gets dropped, if it's lost, if some other kid takes your phone, it's a problem. Also, the school could have liability. The other issue is the teacher can walk around the classroom and just keep telling kids to turn off the phones. Out of all those solutions, it seems to me it's time for us in Hawaii to move forward looking at using technology to solve problems, not just take a political big sledgehammer to say no.
All right, so it remains to be seen how far the rule will go once they come up with the policy.
And it's definitely going to be a collaborative effort with the teachers, administrators, and the parents as well.
Yeah, it's a big effort, a big ask. But thank you so much,
Thanks
Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
That was HPR's Cassie Ordonio. A look for her stories on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Kahilu Theater in Waimea on Hawaii Island, presenting Opera Aloha, an international ensemble celebrating the power and beauty of opera, February 15th. Tickets at kahilu.org.
Artificial intelligence is pushing into every sector, particularly healthcare, and it's changing how doctors treat their patients. So how do we make sure these new AI tools are safe? Dr. Brian Anderson says he has the answer.
The power of these labs is that they're able to issue a really robust evaluation report that would be of great value to the regulatory bodies.
That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2, following the world.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at haleakalaranch.com.
What are the ingredients needed to grow Hawaii's tech industry? Well, for one group, it starts with a zip pack. Carlo Likido is the executive director of Piiku, a nonprofit that is training early career coders. The organization is partnering with Zippies to offer 9 interns real-world experience and mentorship in product design and engineering. Likido spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about his own path in tech and why he founded Piiku as a way to pay it forward.
Kind of similar track to people. I went to college. I came back home. Didn't know what I wanted to do. Rented cars for a little bit. And then found my way into the Department of Education. And I loved it. I loved learning how to code. I loved learning about data. And to me, I was like, data is what I want to do. I want to use data to like improve the world. And that's what we're doing at the Department of Education. And like many people, I went to the continent because I thought I needed to to grow and experience the world. I spent 5 years over in San Francisco and really loved it. And then the silver lining of COVID was that I got to move back home. And my wife is also from here, too. And then I never looked back. I was working for some large tech startups over in SF, and I also worked for some like big tech companies like Autodesk and Shopify. And after I got laid off from Shopify, I was kind of like, why can't more people from Hawaii get into tech? That's why I started my nonprofit, PEKU, to help people break into tech. And that's why I have my own studio.
Let's talk about PEKU and specifically kind of this cohort style internship. Mm-hmm. What does that actually entail?
So what we do is we recruit, train, and deploy emerging tech talent and are trying to build the tech talent pipeline here in Hawaii. And that usually comes in the form of internships or work-based learning models. And for most jobs, but especially in tech, you basically need a job to get a job. And, you know, someone on our team, one of her famous quotes is always, talent is equally distributed, but opportunity is not. And something that we're trying to do with PEKU, because we don't have the same level of opportunity here in Hawaii, is we're trying to create that sort of opportunity. And so we run cohort-based models in which we pair emerging talent with seasoned mentors and companies. So first cohort was companies based both here and on the continent. Our second and third cohort were paired with Blue Startups, which is an accelerator here in Hawaii. And our fourth cohort, which we're so stoked about, is going to be with Zippies. And so, yeah, we always follow a very high-touch, very intentional cohort-based model for emerging talent, all people with connections to Hawaii.
So now you announced that the next cohort's going to be with Zippies. Mm-hmm. That was probably months, if not longer, in the making.
Yeah.
But who got in touch with whom, and how did this partnership arise?
What's cool about the tech ecosystem in Hawaii is that there's a ton of fun energy going around. But unlike San Francisco, where, you know, there's like 3 meetups every single day, there's like hundreds of people. There's like just so many people to try to know. But in Hawaii, it's small enough where you get plugged in and you kind of know the whole ecosystem. And we're really all trying to help each other. You know, I can name a few: Thrive High, Purple Maya. Everyone kind of knows each other. And whenever we have, at the end of our cohort, we always have a large celebration of our interns, Hawike, on which we celebrate our work. And the person from Zippies came to our second cohort, the person who was leading the digital transformation over at Zippies. She was super impressed, got in touch with us, and she said, we'd love to build a cohort with PEKU. And I was like, yeah, let's get it.
And it really seems like this model works particularly well here when you think about that framework you laid out of mm-hmm. you have talent that's distributed, but opportunity in very particular places. But is that what you found, that method has worked?
Totally. It's totally worked. And I think the other kind of, like, if you're going to put like a secret sauce on it, which I'm happy to share the secret sauce and have as many people copy this model as possible, is that when we first started this out with our first cohort, it was me just reaching out to companies and being like, do you want to do this model? And what we found is that companies, you know, you kind of have to take a gamble on emerging talent and junior talent, right? And typically what these companies lack is either expertise or bandwidth. So not have the expertise to actually scope the project, or they don't have the bandwidth to actually take on this like very intentional internship, right? To do something like this, you need a marketing team to do outreach. You need an HR team to like manage the interns. And you need all the other wraparound services throughout the whole 12 weeks. And so, you know, with the case of Zippies, for example, they have the expertise, but they don't have the bandwidth. And so we're providing all these wraparound services. And the second part, okay, third secret sauce, are the mentors, actually. If you think about the mentors, we pair one mentor with one intern. And these are people with like 10 plus years of experience coming from, also Hawaii connected, coming from places like Amazon and Shopify and IDEO. And if they were charging an hourly rate, they'd be charging like upwards of $200 per hour, right? So if you think about them putting in 5 hours a week over the course of 12 weeks times 9 mentors, that's over $100,000 that our mentors are putting in for free. They're paying it forward. And to do something like that, you can't do with a transactional process. You have to do this with like a very Hawaii-based approach, you know, very community approach. So third secret sauce.
Thinking about the trade-off for the company, in this case, what Zippies is going to receive in terms of the interns, how do you make sure that you set them up for success where they're going to turn in things that actually benefit the business, but then they can leave behind and put a ribbon on after 12 weeks?
Yeah, it has to be a completely win-win sort of model. But having the hoike, the end of your celebration, where you invite your community to it, it puts this like really, really big added pressure on the interns. It does. And it's one wonderful that for the community. I think it's really great for the interns who are, you know, some are young, you know, in college, some are transitioning in their 30s. But putting a Hoiki at the end puts this amazing pressure on them to like create something wonderful, not just for their client, but for the community. And I think that actually creates like a really nice recipe for people wanting to do a really, really good job. Also, by the way, like unless you're in college, there's actually not many internships that are available. So if you think about the people who are, which we have a lot of people who are transitioning careers, they see this as like this amazing opportunity, which it is. That's one of the things we look for is like, how eager are you? Like, how hungry are you for this? That's part of like our criteria of like how of people we want who want to break into tech.
There's like a running joke about tech interns and like what software engineers actually do, that it's a lot of building internal tools.
Mm.
Are there examples of things that cohorts have done that are actually public facing?
So Shaka Guide. Shaka Guide is an app for like as a listening tour throughout Hawaii. It's a mobile app. And so one of our interns in cohort one, she actually like redesigned the front page interface of that. Farmlink Hawaii, that was one of our cohort two internships. One, they wanted a new design system, but two, they also wanted a way for EBT customers to be able to navigate their platform more easily, which is super important. So our interns actually redesigned the whole experience for the EBT customer within 8 weeks. And I can't go into the upcoming Zippies projects, but for Zippies, what's amazing is that they're going to actually work on consumer-facing products that I probably will use both that will affect thousands of users. It's a really amazing the level of trust that Zippies is putting in us.
And the results kind of speak for themselves. I saw on the website that of the now few dozen interns that have graduated from this program, their starting salary is in like the 40s of dollars per hour. Uh-huh. And I mean, what else can you share about what they go on to do?
Yeah, we're so stoked. It's a mix of full-time and contract, to be transparent. This is from cohort one and cohort two. Within 3 months, 75% of interns are getting a paid role. And on average, that paid role is $44 per hour. When you look at the diversity of our cohorts, I mean, it's Hawaii, so 90%+ people of color, Native Hawaiian representation, a quarter. When you look at female and non-binary representation, it's 75%. When you look at the rest of the tech industry, it's around 25%. Same thing for the indigenous representation. It's like 0.001% representation. And ours, again, like I said, like 20%+. And so in terms of like diversity and success measures, we're incredibly happy.
So what are the upcoming deadlines if people hear this and they think, oh my gosh, I might be a good fit to digitally transform Zippies?
Yeah.
Applications are open. When are they due?
Cool. So applications are open. They are due by February 21st. We will let know people if we extend, but it is for 9 total interns, 1 product manager, 6 software engineers, and 2 designers. And it'll start March 31st. And part of your onboarding process will be to work in the Zipline kitchen at Zippies.
Anything else in the pipeline or anything else that you want to add?
If anyone's interested in co-hosting a work-based learning model, we're always looking for fun new partners, so get in touch.
Well, thank you so much again for taking the time.
Thank you.
That was Carlo Liquido, who runs the local nonprofit Piiku. He was talking to HBR's Maddie Bender. We will have links to more information about the upcoming internship with Zippy's digital transformation team on our website later today. You know, this past weekend marked a gathering of contemporary Hawaiian artists at the Pa'i Foundation Studio in Kaka'ako. It was to launch something called the Vehi Vehi Initiative, which is the brainchild of choreographer Christopher Cowie Morgan. I was able to catch one of the performances at the beginning of the month, and among the list of risk-taking creatives, new and upcoming artists, as well as others established in their fields, was Kumuhula Patrick Makuakani and composer Lelihua Lenzalati. Both have garnered national recognition for their art. Makuakani won a MacArthur Genius Grant and Lanzalotti just recently the Creative Capital Award, and we'll be hearing more from them in the weeks to come. But today, it's Chris Morgan, who calls himself the instigator of Vehi Vehi, who starts us off.
As we've seen, cultural preservation, Olelo Hawaii, some of our most important practices strengthened since the cultural renaissance of the 70s and 80s. It's been interesting to me as a contemporary dance maker, deeply rooted in my native Hawaiianness, to notice that we face particular challenges in the contemporary Hawaiian performing arts. It's so important that that cultural preservation maintains. But in its state of strength, I've been noticing that it's been harder for those that are working in a sort of experimental or contemporary space rooted in our indigeneity to get both the financial support, the resources of space and time, and a kind of growing audience. We want to develop that audience for that work. So this initiative was born out of a desire to build some solidarity amongst artists that are working in this way. Like any identity group, you know, it's always easier when you're not alone in that work. And so building that solidarity was important. But we also hope to raise awareness of this work. And therefore, over time, this is a long-term initiative, over time, develop audience and understanding of what this work is and how deeply Kanaka work can be, even in contemporary settings.
At the event that we had, there were some powerhouses in attendance. And we have talked to Patrick Makuakani and Lele Hua and Vicky Takamini just about how important it is to innovate. And, you know, things don't stay the same all the time.
That's right. You know, I think a lot about our kupuna and the importance of embracing new ideas and technology. You know, it's one of my favorite things when I get to go back to Iolani Palace and see the tour. And they mentioned, you know, we embraced electricity there ahead of the White House, right? And so this idea of embracing technology or innovation or new ideas, it's deeply rooted in our community. It just was suppressed through colonization for so long. And so now that we feel the strength of our culture, you know, restored, revitalized, I think it's a great time in our own trajectory to really emphasize innovation. And I appreciate that there are powerhouses like Auntie Vicky who are supportive of this. Miley Meyer was at our Saturday night event at Shangri-La, and she came up to me afterwards. And of course, I'm like, wow, that Miley Meyer is coming up to talk the story with me. And she just said how meaningful it was. She said she was shook by seeing this expression of contemporary Kanaka art and performing art, you know, to see these mana wahine that are such examples and role models for me really means a lot, because I think sometimes there's an understandable distrust of folks that want to innovate. And so when some of our most respected leaders model that they are supportive of this, I think it's a great signal to our community that, yeah, we can experiment, we can learn and explore new ideas while maintaining our authenticity and pono intention.
And talk about your story, because you came from the Western approach, correct? You were a dancer. You danced, what, ballet and modern dance?
Yeah. So both of my parents were born here on Oahu. My dad was born in Ka'ava, my mom in Honolulu. But they didn't meet until they were in the Marines in California when they were stationed there. And that's an important part of this story because we grew up, my siblings and I, in diaspora. But of course, grandparents, aunties, uncles, all here. And when I was a child, we danced. It was the early 80s. We danced like very Polynesian revue style, hula Tahitian Aotearoa dances, right? Later, as a teenager, when I was 17, I discovered ballet, modern, and jazz dances, these Western forms. And that became my life's work for the next 10 to 15 years. But there was always this muscle memory and this genetic memory of these Polynesian and particularly Hawaiian dances. And it would show up in my other Western forms in unexpected ways. And so I began to become really curious about that, especially as I started to shift from performer of other people's work to a choreographer making my own dances. And so that curiosity led me to the work of my late cousin Kumuhula John Kaimikawa, whose Halau Kukuna Okala continues to this day here on Hawaii, even though he passed in 2006. It's now led by Kumuhula Elsie Kalihulukea Ryder, who's been a really important teacher to me throughout my journey. But that sort of muscle memory began this curiosity. How can I infuse my own work with my native Hawaiian background and the cultures of that world? And it was a long learning process, of course, to try and do that in a way that felt pono. And so that involves studying with Kumu Elsie. Now I'm very blessed to have more than one Kumu with their permission. I also study with Kumu Patrick Makuakane, who you lifted up earlier. And so these different lineages of hula and culture are now connecting in me and blending with this Western background. It's like my hapa-ness in art.
It's true. You know, when you feel something that is just right and you don't know where it comes from.
Exactly. And in the cohort of Vihi Vihi artists, there's seven of us, we've been talking a lot about how to most tune into our na'au. And there's so many distractions for anyone, whether you're kanaka or not. Like, the world is distracting. It's really hard to listen to your guts or your intuition, to, you know, your most trusted advisors that might be elders, that might be ancestors, that might be akua, that might be other ways of identifying spirituality. But we just get so much distraction in the world that we live in now. And so we've been talking about, how do we listen to our na'au in a way that we can feel pono about our contemporary expression. And I think that's the key, is if we do the research, if we try to understand the subjects or the influences that we're sourcing from, and then can listen deeply, hopefully, and with some consistency, we can trust that we are moving in a good way, in a good path.
Yeah, show respect.
Exactly, exactly.
Because that is some of the criticism, right? You're being disrespectful of tradition.
Exactly. And like I said in a different way earlier, I think it's related to that fear that we so understandably have as Kanaka, because our language is outlawed, our names were outlawed. You know, my middle name is Kawi. When I understood that that law around Hawaiian first names was only repealed in Kalamai, I think like 1968 or something like that, I was so mad. I was like, now I want to change my name. But I was like 27 years old when I learned that, and I had been living with the name, and I had that name in unions that, you know, you have to keep your name. So it was like too late for me to feel like I could change my name. But it's like all of that very real reason to distrust change, I hope, is starting to ebb away a little bit and create new space for expansive ideas and expressed self-expression, but rooted in our indigeneity.
Now, when I saw the performance the other night, that was at the Pa'i Foundation, which helped to start this artist loft concept and this project there in Kaka'ako. And you have some connection with that.
I do. So, as mentioned, I've lived in diaspora most of my life, except for about 2 years when I lived on Maui. For 5 years of my time in Washington, D.C., I ran a venue called Dance Place. And Dance Place had a partnership with Art Space. That's the same kind of arts real estate developer that Auntie Vicky Holtakamine partnered with to develop Olaka'i Lima. And so roughly 15 years ago, as she first started to dream about this, she visited Dance Place in Washington, D.C. as part of the research to develop this beautiful space now in Kaka'ako with affordable living for artists. I understand there's a bit of a wait list to get in there, but it's supporting all these artists here in Hawaii and getting them more affordable housing. As we know, that's one of the biggest crises facing our islands. And this gorgeous space that we were able to be in on Friday night when you were there, that can be used for rehearsals, for performances and sharings like the one that you were at. So it's just such an incredible community resource. And I love that, you know, these different connections from different parts of our lives also find their way here to Hawaii.
Well, what is your hope for Vihi Vihi just going forward?
Moving forward with Vihi Vihi, I hope to continue to support the artists that have been a part of it thus far. We spent equal time talking about systemic change that we hope to influence as to our artistic sharing, and that felt a little out of balance. I feel these artists need a little more time in their artistry. In addition to that, it's always been the vision that this is an ever-expanding circle. We started small with a multi-year vision that we grow big and include more artists in this work. The support of Shangri-La here in Hawaii and the Doris Duke Foundation is what have made this possible to happen. And so we've just had some discussions, I think and hope that they will continue to support this. But also, I've had great conversations with other partners here in Hawaii and on neighbor islands to really make sure that we're reaching the breadth and depth of what's happening in contemporary Kanaka expression in the performing arts. So I think we can look forward to continued initiatives with some of the great names that you surfaced that are part of this cohort and other ways that we're going to work with them in the future. We're even discussing what it means for us to have reciprocal exchanges on the continent so that those artists that are in diaspora have an easier connect, and creating opportunities for artists that are based and rooted deeply here to get connections, networking, and exposure on the continent as well. So we're looking at as kind of concentric circles that kind of expand and contract in back out, just like a breathing lung. Ha.
And so any message you want to leave our audience with, whether they live on a neighbor island or in New York or Indiana, you know?
Well put. I love it. So please keep an eye out for us. Please try and connect with us. You know, you can reach me individually as sort of the instigator of this work, which is a title I chose because it's not something I hope to carry alone. I really want to build a HUI where we do this work together. But you can reach out to me via social media or other platforms. We're looking at developing a specific website and some other resources in the months ahead. All of this, it's a long-standing dream I had, but in reality, what you saw this past weekend came together in just the last 3 months. It was like a big rush to the finish. So we have a lot of other kinds of work we need to do to make this work more accessible and reachable. But I think the thing that I most want other Kanaka contemporary performing artists to hear is you are not alone. There's a hui of us that's growing. We want to work together and build community and solidarity and support each other and network each other into more and more opportunities to take the space that our art deserves.
All right. Well, Chris Morgan, thank you so much for being here this morning.
Mahalo nui. Really excited and grateful for the invitation.
That was choreographer Chris Kawi Morgan talking about a new contemporary art initiative launched this month. Artists performed at the Pa'i Foundation and also at the Doris Duke Foundation's Shangri-La Museum, which helped sponsor the initiative.
Moku o ke ave. Join Hawaii Public Radio at Kahilu Theater on Friday, March 21st for a live taping of The Conversation and Kanikapila Sunday. We talk story with author and longtime Parker Ranch veterinarian Dr. Billy Bergen, Dr. Patrick Hart of Manu Minute, and Hilo singer-songwriter Kainani Kahona Ele. For more information, visit hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Big Island Coffee Roasters and Merriman's Restaurants.
On the next Fresh Air, Questlove returns. He'll talk about the life and legacy of Sly Stone. His new documentary, Sly Lives, a.k.a. The Burden of Black Genius, premieres soon on Hulu. Questlove won the Oscar for another of his music documentaries, Summer of Soul. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
You recently lost a prolific contemporary artist. 98-year-old Satoru Abe died last week. An exhibit of 100 of his paintings at the University of Hawaii at Manoa had been featured. At the same time, the Honolulu Museum of Art launched a show of his body of work that included large and small sculptural pieces. We are closing our show today by rebroadcasting an interview of Abe from 2017. He reflected on his career and offered advice to young artists in Hawaii when he spoke with HPR reporter Noe Tanigawa.
The beauty is to be young, naive, and have a dream. That's all. That's all you need. You have to be young and with a dream. That's all it is. You don't need skill. Skill comes from any repetition of things, okay? And the rest you can time, yeah? You can learn everything. So I was one of the lucky ones, so almost every year I'll sell about $2,000 worth of artwork, okay? If I joke about it and say, if I made $3,000, I'd probably never go back to New York, you know? But, you know, we're talking about, you know, Hanayori Dango, that era, okay? And you know what it means, right? Today, man cannot live by bread alone. See, it changes everything.
Yeah, I guess so, right?
But even that, Hawaii has the potential, and said, yeah. And my feeling is, give every serious artist a chance to show the play. And it will by itself, right? If they sell, because it has to sell, right? It's not for show only. So, and I hope the one don't sell, they will improve themselves, you know, or make it sellable. No, that's a funny term, sellable. But
well, what kind of art do people like? What do they want to buy?
That's the part. We have to look for new buyers. Okay. Well, my collectors are gone up to later, but well, we had well, how many? We had about two times at that place.
You know, look, Satoru. This is for the artists today.
Yeah.
They need collectors. How did you build your collector base? How did you do it?
Yeah, it's kind of strange. Yeah, got to go individual. It's too much to have. Okay, just to give you an idea, okay? I have over 20 collectors who has a minimum of 30 to 120, 30.
How do you explain that?
Okay. Zei Mukai in Maui, okay? He has the most, 130 work. He has every period and every medium, you know, sculpture, painting, company.
Oh, that must be a great feeling, Satoru. Because this person has preserved what you might not have preserved as well.
Yeah. And looking back, you know, if those things didn't sell, I probably won't make, right? Because I have more place, right?
Okay, so now you, look, how are artists going to make it today? The young artists in Hawaii, what is your advice for them today?
Well, today it's wide open, okay? We have a lot of activity, art-wise, okay? And still, a lot of things are just show, right? Okakako is show, no real collector. The thing is, how we're going to attract collectors, new collectors, young collectors. They don't know how to start. Well, you know how
How do collectors start, Satoru?
That's what we got to figure out. Okay. And so, we'll try something. And once they get started, that's it. That is a disease.
Once collectors start collecting, they love it. Yeah. They discover a new world.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Very true. There's a lot of young people who has money. And we're talking about, you know, 1,000, 5,000 at the most a year buying artwork. And that will do it, right? But anyway, we're trying. And can be done, I think. I'll be happy.
That was part of a conversation between artist Satoru Abe and HPR's Noe Tanigawa from 2017. Satoru Abe was named a living treasure back in 1984 for helping to shape modernist art in Hawaii. We'll share the link where you can listen to his full interview. His show at the Honolulu Museum of Art, Satoru Abe Reaching for the Sun, runs through October 2025. That does it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to hear from Big Island Mayor Kima Alameda. Have questions for him? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, and record something. You can find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.